The next case this morning is number 07-1944, Carl Madison against Renator Frazier.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Steve Hettinger, and I represent the plaintiff appellant, Carl Madison. This is a defamation false light case under Illinois law. The issues in this case are identical for both the defamation and false light claims, so I won't be distinguishing between those this morning. With the indulgence of the court, I would like to address the arguments raised in this case in the order presented in my reply brief, as opposed to earlier briefing in this case. As indicated in the reply brief, it seemed to me that that made somewhat more logical sense. And that would put the actual malice issue up first. Actual malice, of course, comes from the New York Times line of decisions requiring for a public figure plaintiff in a defamation case to prove that the defendant either had actual knowledge that the matter stated were false or acted with reckless disregard. And that must be shown with clarity, convincing clarity, and we acknowledge all of those things. The procedural posture, however, does play into this actual malice case, so for just a moment, I'd like to make sure the court is well understanding of that posture. Of course, there was a complaint filed. One defendant, Renata Frazier, filed an answer, but that was withdrawn, and subsequently a motion to dismiss under raising issues under Rule 12 was filed with an additional factual matter attached and the proposal that the court also accept the motion as a Rule 56 motion for summary judgment. A response to that motion to dismiss was filed, but prior to ruling on that motion, the district court converted the motion into one for summary judgment, revised the briefing schedule. The defendants filed a memorandum in support of their motion for summary judgment. A response was filed. There was time in there to do a little bit of discovery concerning the issue raised that converted the matter to a motion for summary judgment, and then the judge ruled on those motions.
And if I may interrupt there for a moment, at page 35 of your brief, there's a suggestion that you don't think you were permitted to have adequate discovery on this issue of actual malice. I very frankly found it difficult to see what you were relying on in the way of factual background to substantiate that.
Well, if I might, yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up, Judge, because when the issue was first raised, it was raised with a letter from a third party, and it was presented by the defendants as source material for the statements made about my client in the book. Now,
that's the Black Guardian's letter?
That's the Black Guardian's letter, yes, and it's supported by an affidavit. We did a little discovery on that issue. We deposed Renata Frazier and we deposed Courtney Mitchell, both of whom, by the way, said no, they didn't rely on that Black Guardian's letter in writing the book. In fact, they didn't look at anything. They just used bare memory. So we took that information back to the district court and said, well, you know, for these reasons and other reasons, which would include that that the Black Guardian's letter wasn't even on the same point. The Black Guardian's letter said, here's why we, the Black Guardians, don't think you, Carl Madison, were doing a good job for it. It doesn't say anything about why Renata Frazier didn't think he was doing a good job for her. So for those two reasons, Judge, you should deny this motion on the actual malice issue. There is no source material that they can look to. Well, the judge actually didn't rule on that issue. I don't believe in his final order he even touches that. He passed over it and said, well, because this is a first-person account, you'll never be able to show that she doubted her own memory. You'll never be able to show that she was somehow wrong in her own memories, and therefore you can never show with convincing clarity that there was actual malice. That's the issue that, you know, I would posit that maybe if the court needs more, if that is actually what the standard is, that I did not have any opportunity to conduct discovery on. What discovery? There was a third party. I discovered this when I deposed Renata Frazier. There was a third party private editor who edited this Mm-hmm. Well, she may have information relevant to that. I would like to go back and depose Renata Fraser and Courtney Mitchell more on this particular issue because, again, our depositions were limited to the issue, primarily the issues, the specific issues raised in the defendant's motion. The district court moved that into a different direction that had not previously been before us, and so there was no opportunity to probe into that at all. However, having said that, I've also argued and continue to argue that even looking at that issue, there is evidence to suggest strongly that this actual malice standard can be met. Because, first off, we know that Renata Fraser didn't like Carl Madison. She had every reason to fabricate and to elaborate and expand beyond reality her objections to him. We also know that there are other matters and materials in the book that are false. They're just wrong. She puts her lawyer as, and she presents this in a way as to puff him up. He's from Peoria, not from Springfield, not Chicago, but at least he's Peoria, better than Springfield, bigger town than Springfield, when in fact he's from Benton. Well, you know, that's a peripheral issue, but the point is that if she's doing that, what might she do with Carl Madison?
So essentially, it seems to me what you need to do, and perhaps where the judge was taking you part of the way, is although this is a first-party account, the Supreme Court has said you can't just say it's my first-party account, ergo no defamation is possible, that you need to explore circumstantial ways. I presume Ms. Fraser's not going to say I fabricated the whole first, or I was reckless or things like that, but you need to find circumstantial evidence, whether it's from other inaccuracies or whether it's from the editor or other people.
And that would be my position, too,
so
Your
Honor.
So
what do you have at the moment? You were starting to say you do have some circumstantial evidence about actual malice now. I want to...
Well, she has, although we didn't touch on this specific point, during her deposition she did say she doesn't recall all of her conversations verbatim with Carl Madison, although then she purports to have written them down. As I said, she does have a clear animosity towards him. She, we know there are other inaccuracies in the book. I've cited and quoted, and in the materials there is a news article or an editorial from a contemporary reporter who covered this whole affair and who said there are a lot of inaccuracies in this, some of which she believes she, that reporter, attributed to this animosity, the very animosity that this lawsuit covers. I'd also point out that all of the facts, everything that the circumstances that took place in this book concerning Carl Madison occurred 4 years before she published the book. And I would argue that that circumstantially shows an intent to hide her head in the sand with some of the assertions. For instance, her assertion that Mr. Madison was after some sort of a political appointment. Well, had he received one in those 4 years? As a matter of fact, no. But, you know, she never went to bother to check that out. She just posited in her book that he had those motives.
Are you focusing more on actual knowledge of falsity or reckless disregard?
At this point, Your Honor, as to that issue, I would have to say actual knowledge. I mean, this is a memoir. This is, you know, this is purported to be her memory. If she is trying to think of something and has no specific memory, she can't just make it up. And if her memory is blurred, if she doesn't go and look up a source, I would say that would be reckless disregard. But it would also be knowledge of actual falsity if she just makes it up. But again, we didn't probe into that issue because the specific issue that was raised by the pleadings was with respect to that letter. And I believe, again, sub silentio, the district court seemed to agree that that letter was not source material because the district court never ruled on that. And I would argue that that was a correct ruling since both Mrs. Fraser and her son, Courtney Mitchell, had disassociated themselves with that letter. Both of them said, we didn't look at anything. We just relied on our memory. We didn't look at newspaper articles. We didn't talk to people. We didn't talk to people to get their, to bounce off these memories to see if we were correct. They just wrote down what was in Renata Fraser's brain.
So for that reason, that in itself is reckless disregard?
Well, I would argue so, Your Honor.
Did you argue?
I believe I did, yes. That at least in the context of that, the context was that the argument was that this letter serves as source material. Source material automatically gives a pass to the person who relied on the source material. And I believe that's correct case law for third-party accounts. If a reporter has a semi-reliable, I guess if you know it's an unreliable source, that wouldn't apply. But if the source material is what you're relying on in reporting something, then you have the protection of the actual malice standard.
But let me just say, I mean, I understood you to be arguing that if a person were to write a book and say Smith lied last Tuesday when he said such and such, that if you don't somehow make sure that that's, if you don't do any fact checking, if you're relying on a 4-year-old memory and so on, that could be a statement made with reckless disregard.
I would agree with that.
I'm asking, that's your position. So,
Yes. I'm just trying to clarify, though, that the issue as it was raised in the pleadings mm-hmm. before the district court were really focused on that letter. And it's whether that letter itself was that source material, not whether she otherwise, you know, had acted with reckless disregard, but instead was mm-hmm. whether that letter constituted slam dunk proof that I could never make my case. And that's why it was brought up in such a rapid fashion in the pleadings. And I suppose, you know, that would have been appropriate if that actually had been source material. We don't want to waste time in litigation that is going to go nowhere. But in this case, I don't believe that letter was source material, and I believe the district court agreed. The second issue...
You're into your rebuttal time, you know.
You're right, Your Honor. I will reserve the rest to see what comes up during the other argument.
Thank you, Mr. Hedinger. We'll hear now from Mr. Craven.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Don Craven for the defendants in this matter. The statement that according to the district court is at issue in this case is the statement that Mr. Madison lied to Ms. Fraser. These two people have a disagreement and will forever have a disagreement about who was responsible for their divorce. Most divorcing couples usually do. Ms. Fraser thinks that she left Mr. Madison, and Mr. Madison thinks that he left Ms. Fraser. The statement that he lied is the statement that he lied when he said that Ms. Fraser that he left Ms. Fraser before Ms. Fraser left Mr. Madison's support and the support of the NAACP. The reason the Guardian letter is important in this case is because it is independent. It is from an independent party. It's from one of the other black officers in Springfield, and supports Ms. Fraser's view that she left the NAACP. The NAACP didn't withdraw their support from her first. This is a first-party account. And the plaintiff must show reckless disregard for the truth or knowledge of the truth. Mr. Madison, can't do that in this case.
Well, why? I don't quite understand that, because certainly it is a first-party account, but the Supreme Court has said that you have to say more than that to win. And as your opponent points out in the reply brief, there have been both recent examples, and I can think of older examples, where people portray things as first-party accounts, and sometimes they're entirely fictional, and sometimes they're a blend of fact and fiction. Some reporters have been called up for creating composites that were presented as true accounts. There are all kinds of things that can happen. So that's the first party account thing. I think the second concern is that the district court did find that the statement in Chapter 8, you know, he lied to me, was a defamatory statement. This part of the case went off on the actual malice showing, and if she made that statement, reckless disregard for the truth, not looking at the Black Guardian's letter, not looking at anything, then perhaps a jury should decide, if the facts could, if believed by a trier of fact, I want to be precise here, could show that, then perhaps a jury ought to have this case. We're not sitting here to decide the case. We're sitting here to decide whether enough has been presented to let a jury decide it.
That's correct. And there may be misstatements of fact in this case.
And the question is there enough evidence in this record to show that those statements were made with either actual knowledge of falsity or reckless disregard for the truth?
No, because the record in this case does not show that there is clear and convincing evidence of actual malice, of reckless disregard, with respect to the actionable statement, according to the district court.
Well, also a debate about whether the sellout statement is actionable. I'm going to put to one side the fantasy sequence because I'm less interested in that. But what about that? I take it it's not disputed. The timeline isn't disputed. That this book comes out quite a few years, 4 years or so later, and that she doesn't in any way go back and check the accuracy of anything that she's put down.
No, she wrote this from her memory.
Right, so she does no fact-checking at all as to a single fact that appears in the book.
But the fact that we're concerned with here is who left who.
Right, and so she doesn't do any fact-checking on that either. She doesn't go back and look at a calendar. She doesn't go check her phone records. She doesn't do anything.
That's correct. But her recollection of those events and that she withdrew from the support of the NAACP before they left her. Her support of those events is supported by the Black Guardian's recollection of those events.
But that's a different angle. That doesn't go to the question whether she was exhibiting reckless disregard for the truth. That might mean that upon a trial, she might have a defense of truth. That's a different issue in a defamation case than reckless disregard.
But
if she didn't even know the Black Guardian said that.
Well, she said she didn't rely on the letter. There's no evidence that she didn't know that was the position of the Black Guardians.
Well, but wouldn't that be important? I mean, she needs, the way she presented it, this was entirely her recollection. So if she had said Mr. Madison was a child pornographer, if she had said anything, all from her recollection, it's your view she can say any of these things without bothering to check up on the facts?
No. She can say those things. The issue in this case is there sufficient evidence to a clear and convincing standard to show that she acted with reckless disregard? And
well, could a jury find that to a clear and convincing standard she acted with reckless disregard?
I believe that under the Supreme Court precedent, the St. Amant case and, mm-hmm. and those cases, the obligation in these cases is on the plaintiff to establish that this is an entire fabrication, that she made this whole thing up. And
of course it's a he said, she said, and so if he were to testify before a jury that it was an entire fabrication, he presents his old journals and he presents things and says, I didn't lie about anything, suppose a jury believed him and didn't believe her. Isn't that enough to support a verdict?
No, because in this
why wouldn't that be enough to support a verdict?
In this case, it's not enough to get to a jury.
Why?
Because in this the burden is on the plaintiff in this case to show at this state clear and convincing evidence of actual malice.
And he's shown that she didn't check anything, and he's shown that she didn't rely on anything. He's shown the animosity. If believed by a trier of fact, and he has shown that there were no motives that he had other than simply to run the NAACP, I'm not sure why, without resolving these factual issues, we can come to the conclusion as confidently as you have.
And I think it's as Mr. Hedinger said in his argument, it's the existence of that independent evidence that her recollection.
Mr. Hettinger didn't think that the independent evidence helped you at all, but anyway, that's...
Well, the existence of, I mean, her recollection, this is a he said, she said. These people will go to their graves, each believing that
right,
they are
that,
right.
Why doesn't that make it a jury issue, and at some point she may choose to raise a defense of truth? You know, I said you lied, and here I can prove that you really did. It's a different part of the case.
Then every first person case goes to a jury.
What you're suggesting is that if truth is the only requirement to get the play out, then all these cases are gone. Because you have to delve into absolute truth, not a mistake, not a mistake in worrying about your memory. If I understand your point correctly.
If it's a he said, she said, and it's a first-person account.
Yeah, then you have to show by clear and convincing evidence that you said something maliciously, and it was either wrong, and you knew it was wrong, or you should have done something about it.
And in that case, and under that analysis, every case is a jury case.
That's right.
And I don't believe that's the purpose of the clear and convincing evidence standard. I don't think that's consistent with the requirement in the Supreme Court precedent that these matters, that first person accounts, yes, it's not enough.
It would be not enough to prove that what she said was a lie. You'd have to show more than that. By clear and convincing evidence, she did it maliciously.
That's correct.
Public figure.
That's correct.
And why don't we have evidence of malice here? Evidence that she violently disliked this man. And that seems to come out throughout the entire book, I have to say, as well as the whole record. So I don't know that we just have, I left, you left. We have a lot of evidence in addition to that here.
Which falls in the category of common law malice, ill will, and not necessarily constitutional malice.
Well, but it supports, isn't it probative of the reckless disregard point? It may not be enough by itself. You're probably quite right, but...
I think it's clearly not enough by itself, and I think
it's not by itself. We have his sworn statement that it wasn't true, and we also have all the rest of this supporting evidence, which would take us away from there's always a jury trial if, you know, I say A and you say not A.
Except that you also have the supporting evidence from the Black Guardians that Ms. Frazier's recollection is correct.
Wow.
And given that, as in a fair comment case, the existence of those sources, the existence of that supporting data, puts this case in.
The procedural posture, the case comes to us. That letter from the guardians, what role did that play in deciding the motion for summary judgment? Was it before the court, am I right?
It was before the court.
How did it get before the court?
It got before the court in response... In support of a motion to dismiss that was then converted into a Rule 56.
I see.
No effort was made to depose the Black Guardians. No effort was made to question the Black Guardians' position that on who left who. That letter was before the court, and Mr. Hettinger's right. It's not that letter is not necessarily relied upon by the district court.
And the record in the district court, what evidence did your opponent have? Concrete evidence submitted to the district court on the summary judgment motion litigation that there was malice.
They had the evidence of common law malice that these people don't like each other.
Right.
They had evidence that there were other mistakes that were made in this book, Mr. Cox's hometown, clearly not related to Mrs. Frazier's recollection of who left who. And they had, you know, the allegations are that my client's statements are self-serving, as are Mr. Madison's that he made in support of his allegations of malice. There was no independent evidence of an effort by Ms. Frazier to
fabricate
fabricate, in the words of St. Amant.
Some substance that was the motion.
That was the
record.
Yes.
That was presented to the district court, right?
I thought there was also the evidence from her deposition in which she said she didn't do any fact-checking. In other words, the district court knew that she had made all of these statements without looking into their accuracy.
That's correct.
Okay.
I see my time is
waning. It's not up yet.
If there are no further questions, I'll release my remaining 17 seconds.
Apparently not, Mr. Craven. Thank you.
Thank you.
How much time does Mr. Hedinger have? Thank you. Mr. Hedinger, perhaps you could begin by telling me what, if anything, was omitted by your colleague in describing the record before the district court.
In terms of the factual basis for the actual malice?
That's correct.
I believe, go through my list here, the things that I had said earlier included that in her deposition testimony, she admitted that she had, and so did her son, by the way, so both of them agreed that there was no fact-checking. There were no source material. She also said that...
What she said was she relied on her memory.
Yes. Yes. And she did. Now, she did say that on some things she would go to certain people and say, you know, what year did you join the police force? Yeah. So she would get those facts
so
right.
She wouldn't know that. She wouldn't have known that from her memory. That would not
correct.
Be part of her memory.
Right. But she didn't look at any contemporary news articles. She didn't talk to other people. She doesn't keep a diary. She says she's not a diary kind of person. So, and Mr. Craven's correct on those things. She did also acknowledge to a degree, and I don't want to overstate it, but she did say in her deposition that she doesn't recall all the conversations she had with Mr. Madison because there were so many of them. So we know that there's a little fuzziness there. We also know that from just the one I pointed out, the hometown of her lawyer, that there's at least one glaring error on something you would expect her to know about, and presented in a way that puffs her story. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
That doesn't strike me as being particularly pertinent to the thing. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, the reason I think, first off, I guess it's just a propensity to error, which the reporter also took note
which
of.
Which is not an indication of malice.
Well, it may not be, other than I would add it to the rest of the things. If she's just flying off
and... Added to the fact she
didn't like him. Pardon me?
Added to the fact she didn't like him.
That, in particular, I would say is a very significant point.
Mr. Hedinger, with respect to first-person accounts, what does the law of Illinois say about, on the question of malice, as to how a court should weigh... a failure to verify facts?
Well, not only in Illinois, but elsewhere, I found very few cases that really do a good job of distinguishing the first person versus a third person narrative. I've cited the Catalano versus Pecus case in my materials where I believe the Supreme Court did make that distinction without drawing, using so many words, because in that case they pointed out that the defendant in that case had made, he was the source of the material himself. So the court rejected his argument that, well, I thought I was right. And that was pretty much directly what his defense was. I thought I was right, and so therefore, you can't prove that I was acting with malice. And the court said, no, wait a minute, you're the source of that material. What you did actually was to make an assumption based on some facts you know, that these, in that case, it was some elected officials had acted, under bribery. The court said, well, there could be other reasons. So your speculation that it was bribery came from you, not from another source.
I think we have the point, Mr. Hedinger. Thank you.
Very much.
Our thanks to both Mr. Hedinger and to Mr. Craven, and the case will be taken under advisement.